This is Dr. Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host for the American Counseling Association's 2014 podcast series. Today we are speaking with Emma Schmidt about female sex and love addiction. Emma Schmidt, MA, PC, CST, CCSAS, is a certified sex therapist in private practice in Boston, Massachusetts. She has given and received many trainings on sex addiction, female sex addiction, and love addiction. She is a member of the American Association for Sex Education, counselors and therapists, the Society for the Advancement of Sexual Health, the Society for the Scientific Study of Sexuality, and the International Association of Certified Sex Addiction Specialists. Welcome, Emma.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Well, let's start out by saying, what is female sex and love addiction?
Yeah, so female sex and love addiction looks like what you would typically see as an addiction. So similar symptoms, similar behaviors like an obsessive component, compulsive, secretive nature. There's a tolerance that can happen over a time, reckless behavior, reckless nature that occurs. But specifically if we're thinking about female sex and love addiction, we're thinking about a sexual component also with a love component that happens. So for instance, the reason why we say it's female sex and love addiction is because for women, what we find is that the love also attaches a lot to why the sex addiction might be happening. So female sex and love addiction looks like those symptoms, looks like those kind of addictions. And a big piece for women for female sex and love addiction is this idea of fantasizing and being swept away. So, for instance, if you think about whenever you were a kid, a lot of girls, stereotypically, we might think of being little girls, and a lot of times we're groomed to fantasize with the Disney movies and the stories that we are told.
So is that, is that like Cinderella, my prince is going to come and sweep me away, that kind of thing?
Exactly, exactly, yeah. So a part of that is that love piece, and then not only does that love and fantasy come, but then the addiction for the sexual component attaches onto that. So that's why we a lot of times say that it's not just female sex addiction, but it's female sex and love addiction, because there's that love component that tends to become messy within the sexual addiction. So so what we see then with what we might consider a healthy functioning person versus someone who might be under a compulsive or sexual addiction area is that when someone with a more healthy component is functioning like a healthier woman, we might find that they're aroused through physical and psychological stimulation, where otherwise being aroused would be difficult. So for a woman who is under the category of female sex and love addiction, typically the way that they become aroused is through core messages like, I'll never be good enough, or no one will ever love me as I am, or past trauma. And that tends to fuel then acting out in their sexual addiction, acting out into the fantasies and the love component. So typically that's how we, in a very compressed way, how we would define and look at female sex and love addiction.
Does some of this female sex and love addiction take place online?
It does, yeah. So a big piece to how to differentiate specifically for men and women is when we think about sex addiction, typically what we might think about is specifically for thinking about an online nature is pornography. And though some women do get themselves involved in pornography, we see that porn is more associated with men when we think about sexual addiction. The online nature comes for women in more of a fantasy realm. Mm-hmm. So there was a book the book that has done some research on this online nature is called A Billion Wicked Thoughts. Mm. And what he shows through his research is that the top erotic websites viewed by men and women look very different. So for men, the top five websites that were viewed were like Pornhub.com, RedTube.com, XHamster, YouPorn, and then XNXX.com. For women, what we found was the top five erotic websites that were viewed were fanfiction.com, stephaniemyers.com, eharlequin.com, adultfanfiction, and then forthegirls.com. What we find is that the online nature for men is more visually stimulating, that they tend to go more for that visual stimulation, where women go more for the storytelling. So a lot of the women that I had seen, that I'd seen with female sex love addiction, will get involved with fan fiction, will get involved with the storytelling piece of it, because there's that fantasy element of building up the excitement of conquering and going on this quest of pursuing someone and then providing that sexual stimulation, where we find with men that it tends to be more of the visual stimulation.
Is there anything else that's different about male sex addiction as opposed to female sex and love addiction?
Yeah, so for men, we'll find that the online nature typically is more for pornography with men, and for women, it is the fantasy piece, the fan fiction part. Mm-hmm. But also what we find is that women tend to do more chat rooms and tend to do more pursuing of a relationship. Mm. So the big piece, one of the big distinguishes between men and female sexual addiction is that for women, we find that there's a relationship component attached to the sex addiction. Mm. So for men, we find that they will pursue prostitutes or pornography, anonymous sex. We find that men tend to be more into frauderism, which is you might find these people on subways rubbing themselves against somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And you won't see that really with women. We won't find that with women. For women, we find that there's more sexual conquest, working as prostitutes, the sadomasochism stuff, where there's they want to conquer, they want to be that domineering person. Mm-hmm. They feel very satisfied by that. And then a big piece that we find right now is exhibitionism.
Hmm.
And so not only with being in porn or being a prostitute, but exhibitionism can be showing too much skin or showing skin to provide a power, feeling powerful. So too much cleavage, or wearing really short skirts, or wearing shirts that are really see-through. So we're seeing right now in culture that showing a lot of skin tends to be a fashion piece right now. And so we have to really filter through how much is that for like a power conquest piece, and filter in powering through their addiction, and how much is a fashion I am really interested in expressing myself through art piece.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What? So you mentioned that some women would like to dominate or be a dominatrix. Are there also women who, with a sex and love addiction, who want to be submissive?
Yes. So there are some people who want to be submissive. What we find there are the people who want to be submissive are still in the control role, if that makes sense. So say there's a relationship, there's some kind of agreement where the woman's going to be the submissive one. She still has control over what's going to happen. She still has the power in what is yes and what is no and what safe words are being provided at that time. And so it becomes very much a psychological twist in that role of submissive versus domineering. So some women, what we find they like to do when they fall into this category, we'll see them go to bars, and we'll see them flirt, and we'll see them make advances and try and pursue partners, men, women, and feeling that control, feeling that conquest, feeling that power that they can say yes or no to the person at any time. So that feels really empowering for them, which is interesting. But what we find in the very beginning for men and women is there was a research done a few years ago, which is also in this book, Billion Wicked Thoughts, that suggests and has found that in the fetus, like when boys and girls are being developed.
Mm-hmm.
What we find is that around 8 weeks old, there's a shift that happens in the neural pathways for female and male brains. And for male brains, during about week eight of the growth, there's a sudden power surge of testosterone that takes place in the male brain that kills off some cells located in the communication centers of the brain, which is also, it also enlarges areas of the brain that work with aggression and sex. So what they found is that for female brains, they don't have that surge of testosterone, and their brains tend to stay a little bit more configured for social connections. So what they suggested were that some male brains then are more hardwired towards systematic thinking and reasoning, while some female brains are more hardwired for social connection. And that also kind of ties back into the fantasy piece versus the visual stimulation, and not only with addiction, but also how we relate to each other just on a relational level and arousal and desire phase. But it helps clue us into why female and male addiction might look different. So I found that really interesting.
It's very interesting.
What
is the prevalence of female sex and love addiction?
So this is very interesting. We don't hear a lot about female sex addiction.
Right.
Yeah, and so this field isn't necessarily new to me, but I'm a young clinician, and it's always amazing to me how female sexual addiction still isn't being talked about as much as I would think that it would be.
Yeah.
So when looking at the research, what I found is that sexual addiction in the U.S., the population is about 3-6% of all U.S. population. Within that 3-6%, 40-50% of the population who fall under sexual addiction are women, which is amazing to me because it's basically almost half and half men and, and women. And so it's very interesting that we talk about men, we talk about how this is seen in media or seen just in our offices, and that we really don't hear much about female sexual addiction. And I think one of the problems is that it's just really understudied because we don't realize, or we hadn't realized, that it actually looks different than male sexual addiction. So we were studying it wrong and weren't necessarily looking at that women might identify or might produce symptoms that are different than men. And also because there is an idea of what male sexual addiction looks like, females aren't necessarily coming forth or being diagnosed, and even though there's not really a diagnosis for it, as female sex addiction, because there isn't a lot of information out. Even though there's more coming out, there isn't really a lot of information out there for clinicians to say, oh, this is what this looks like.
I'm wondering also if it isn't one of a couple of diagnoses in a clinical setting. For example, I saw a woman years ago who was complaining of depression, but when I started talking to her, what I found out is that she was actually extremely tired, and one of the reasons she was extremely tired is she was staying up all night in these chat rooms, having sexual experiences, but also love or romance experiences online with strangers. So she came in saying it was depression, and then it became something else. Is this something you see?
Yes, exactly. So because there isn't a diagnosis either, we were hoping that it would get introduced into the DSM-5. As hypersexual arousal disorder, and that didn't happen, and we're hoping that the idea is that it's part of the revision for the next DSM 5.1 or whatever that one would be. But in any case, we have to think about, so what diagnostically are these people coming in presenting with, and depression is definitely one of them. We also see impulsive control disorder, sexual disorder, NOS, paraphilia, delusional disorder. A big one is ADD and ADHD. And then certain medications, this is why it's really important to get a really comprehensive idea of what is going on with your client.
What does the addiction cycle look like with female sex and love addiction?
Yeah, so what we find is that for men and women, really for a lot of addictions, the addiction cycle looks very similar. Mm-hmm. So what we find is that, or I guess one idea, one thought, is that addictions can stem from core messages that are happening, like I'll never be good enough, no one will love me as I am, and that gets the ball rolling with addictive behavior. So once I start to think those things, then I start to think negative thoughts about myself, about who I am as a person, and then I start to get into a behavior. So, for instance, if I think I'll never be good enough as I am, maybe something that I think might make me feel better is to have power or to feel like someone does love me or someone does care about me. And so then I get into behaviors like getting online and seeking out chat rooms or seeking out different storylines that make me feel excited, make me feel like someone wants me, makes me feel like I'm important. So what happens is because those feel stimulating, because those feel arousing, then I create a pattern and a habit for myself. Whenever I get online, I am already stimulated in thinking, oh, I wonder if this person's online, or I wonder what storyline is happening here, or I wonder, I have a few minutes, I can check out, you know, X, Y, and Z website, or I wonder if this partner is available. And then the behavior happens, and usually after the behavior happens, we feel really bad about ourselves. We feel guilty. We feel ashamed. We feel like, how could I do that? I feel that's not who I am at all. And then we go into either talking negatively about ourselves or saying, I'll never do that again. And what we find is that then whenever we feel bad again, whenever those core messages come up, whenever maybe we're really busy or we're stressed out, it feels better to escape into this other life. Mm. And so we go back into that behavior. So, for instance, say I'm a nurse and I'm at a hospital and I just had a really difficult procedure that happened and I feel like I wasn't my best. What I know is that there's a guy that also worked at the hospital that has said he was interested in me, and so I'm going to walk around and see if he's there. I know he's there, and I know he wants to make advances on me, so I flirt with him. We go to his car. I give him oral sex. I feel really dirty and gross about that because that's not who I am. So then I go back to the hospital, and I say I'm never going to do that again. On my way home, this brings in co-occurring addiction. On my way home, I feel bad about sleeping with that guy, so I go and I get a dozen donuts and I eat them on my way home because I'm engaging in another addiction. And so what we find is that not only can one addiction be happening at one time, but you could be picking and choosing and going into one addiction from the other. So even though female sexual and love addiction might be getting better, you might find that eating addiction might be happening at the same time, or some kind of money addiction or something else. So it's really important to be cognizant of what else might be happening to men to be the drug of those core messages. And that's why it's really important to for clinicians to work on the core messages while also working on reducing the behavior as well, because we find that that tends to be where the addiction is coming from.
Mm-hmm. And would it sometimes be alcohol and drug addiction as well?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
What does a woman's identity tend to look like with female sex and love addiction?
Yeah, so this is another area that tends to be a little bit different for men and women. More women are more likely to identify by being addicted to the person than having an addiction to sex. So they might find that they're a little bit more obsessed with the person than being involved in a sexual behavior or identifying that they're in a sexual addiction behavior. They're more interested in that power and conquest. And sex becomes more of hopes more of hope and receiving a deeper desire of a relationship, of love, of receiving those, like amend to those messages, that those core messages that we talked about. Mm-hmm. And the pursuit of sex is really about something more romantic. So with identity, there was research done by one of the big names in female sex and love addiction field. Her name is Marnie Faree. Mm-hmm. And they just did a survey a couple of years ago, and they surveyed about 500 people. And out of those 500 people, 70% of those women found that their behavior was degrading. So there's something about it that women are able to identify and say, like, this behavior isn't right. It doesn't feel right, but we don't know what it is. They feel bad about sexually acting out. One of the other big pieces of identity is this shame-based piece. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I know there was the movie Shame came out, which was really powerful about a man and his kind of journey through shame. But what we find with women versus men is that it can be the idea, though I don't like to say that some people experience shame more than others, mm-hmm. what we find is that women do tend to get it from media, from society, the shame base a little bit more than men. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we see this kind of all over the place, but for instance, one of the big kind of sexual media pieces would be like The Bachelorette, Bachelor. Mm-hmm. And so when there are women on The Bachelor, they're all in bikinis, they're kind of doing their own thing. What we'll hear are comments like, oh my gosh, they're all really slutty, they're all easy, they're all whores. These messages are very negative. Mm-hmm. This past season on The Bachelorette, there were men who were doing a striptease, and there was really no backlash about it at all. It was like, oh my gosh, they're so sexy, they're so hot, they're so built, they're manly, like that's how a man performs. Mm-hmm. So this is how we're seeing a difference. Women, there tends to be a lot more negative stigma around acting out, where men, it seems to be more like, wow, good job, you did a great job, like that's what men do. Mm-hmm. So though it's still very shameful for men when they're working through the recovery process and in their behavior, that's what we tend to find with women, that it can look a little different in that way. It can be a little bit more shaming, and they're experiencing that as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do boundaries or lack of boundaries look like with female sex and love addiction?
Yeah, so boundaries, women are more likely to say, I have a hard time saying no than actually admit that they had an obsession with sex. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, I had a group of women who said, well, I just get really drunk and then I don't know what's happening and then I feel bad about my behavior the next day. And I started to call them out a little bit about that. And after a while, they started to admit that they actually weren't that drunk, that they actually only had maybe one drink, maybe a few sips, but they definitely knew what was happening. And it feels better to them to say, I had a hard time saying no because of the situation, because of being intoxicated, than admitting that there's this obsession or this compulsive nature with sex, and unable to think about anything else but pursuing this person for sex more. That brings in more of the relationship, relational nature than men who, it might be just about the sex. For women, it tends to be more about the relational piece of connecting with someone, this false intimacy. So that's a big piece of sexual addiction as well, is that we tend to say that it's an intimacy disorder. Intimacy is taken out of it. We're trying to pursue intimacy, but it tends to be false intimacy. So being involved in multiple relationships and seeking a high of this newness of power and conquest. So it's not as exciting if I go after the same guy because I know I can have him. Mm-hmm. So it's better to go after somebody else. It feels more exciting. It feels more powerful. Mm-hmm. So one of the symptoms that I have found is this obsessive thinking about the person or the situation. So I had one person who she was trying to pursue this guy, and it wasn't happening. And so she found herself following him around the country in a stalking manner. And we'll find that as a way of faking out like a fantasy or faking out the intimacy, believing that it's real, even though it was a hookup or even though they weren't interested in sex. There becomes an obsessive nature just in with the person.
Mm-hmm.
Boundaries also look like for women risking sexual behaviors in hopes for getting a deeper need met in dangerous situations.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about it, a lot of women going home with random guys just is not safe at all. Or going home with other women, it's just not a safe environment. But what I found and what the research is finding is that women tend to more likely risk danger for this pursuit of sex, for this hope of a connection. One person.
Why is there so much desperation that one would risk danger?
Because of the hope of filling that message, that core message.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe this person will see me and love me and want me, and then everything will be great. Maybe I can be part of that fantasy.
Mm-hmm. I can have the fairy tale then.
Exactly. It's almost like trying to create this attachment, trying to heal this attachment wound, but in the wrong way, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So there was one situation where a woman knew she was with someone else who was also a sex addict, and they had done everything sexually, but one thing that hadn't been done was anal sex, and that was because she had a situation that if she had anal sex, she could potentially die. But she knew that that's what her partner really wanted more than anything. And he wasn't committing to her. He wasn't committing to a long-term relationship. And that's what she really desperately wanted. And so she came into the office one day and she said, I had anal sex. And we talked about that. And it was really because she wanted him to propose and wanted to get married to him. And he was just doing it because that was another newness for him.
Mm.
So risking that I could almost die, but I'm going to do it because I hope that I can have this, I hope that he would commit to me, nature to it. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, but we don't really see that, as much with men.
Yeah. Interesting. And there must be cultural considerations. What cultural considerations are there?
Yeah. So cultural considerations, if I think about cultural considerations in terms of, let's say, like the college hookup crowd,
okay.
That's something that I need to take into play whenever I'm working with college-age clients. So what is addiction? What is hookup? What is, you know, it becomes very messy right now with not only college age anymore, but just culture and what's a hookup from what's addiction. So hooking up can become very, I think of it as like the new fast food of dating. It's not healthy, but it's better than nothing. And women are more focused on careers today than building a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is the hookup is less about sex and more about trying to find an instantaneous deep connection for a few minutes to satisfy a core issue.
Mm-hmm.
And for men, it would be more about the release of a connection, like a release more than a connection.
Oh.
So, yeah, so getting that ejaculatory response out, getting all of that out, and the woman just being able to have something close, having that close intimacy, this false intimacy, and then they can both go on their way.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some research done a few years ago, too, about 500 people, they interviewed some undergrad students,
mm-hmm.
and what was found was that women reported emotional gratification in hooking ups, and about 43% of women hoped for a romantic relationship to form as a result of the hookup, while only 8%, well, not only, but 8% expected a relationship afterwards. And so if we think of hookups, we think of it's something that we are doing just to satisfy ourselves, and then we kind of move on about our day, or we move on the next day. But what's interesting is that many women are actually hoping and desiring for a relationship afterwards, where men are just kind of good to go. They're off onto their next thing. And so that's really important in working with men and women when we're talking about hookup culture,
mm-hmm.
And that can play a very big role in in what's going on with the addiction piece, but also with cultural considerations. I was leading some groups, and there were female groups, of course, and then I was doing interviews, and what I found were that there were some same-sex couples who wanted to be a part of the group, and that's something to also take into consideration is if you're leading groups, if you are working with couples, what do you do then if a same-sex couple wants to be a part of the group or wants to be involved and trying to figure out how do I help both partners in all of that.
I was wondering, when you mentioned the undergraduate college age kids, I was thinking of when I worked at a college counseling center back when I was getting my master's, I remember that we would see behavior that looked like alcoholic behaviors in the students, but they would turn out not to be alcoholic behaviors. They actually were mm-hmm. age-specific, developmental-specific. They didn't actually go on to become alcoholics, but the behavior that you saw during the undergraduate period looked like alcoholic behavior. So I'm wondering mm-hmm. if you see the same thing with female sex and love addiction, with a behavior that might look like female sex and love addiction or male sex addiction during that period of time, which actually turns out not to be. Do you understand my question?
Yeah, and I'm really glad you brought that up because that's one of the reasons why I brought up the hookup culture.
Mm-hmm.
But I forgot to tie it into that is exactly that we'll see college kids that look like they have alcoholic behaviors or dependent behaviors towards alcohol, but really it's the environment in which they're in. Like that's the culture of where they're at right now. And so then the debate becomes, is it alcoholism or is it the environment? Is it the culture of college, you know? And that's the same with the hookup culture that we see with female sex and love addiction. We can find that it looks very much like female sex and love addiction, but what is really happening is that it is very much based on the environment in which they're in. It's that college experimentation, exploring experience that's happening, but what we need to also consider is, but what part is playing what? You know, what part is really coming from the core message? What part is really damaging? And what part is just having fun and exploring and going from one partner to the other?
Mm-hmm. What does this look like diagnostically? I know you mentioned that there isn't a hypersexual arousal disorder in the DSM. So when you're looking at the DSM criteria or other criteria, what are you looking at diagnostically when it comes to this disorder?
Mm-hmm. So there are a number of disorders that you could potentially diagnose under, and it's going to be very different from person to person because the criteria might, you know, look different, even though an umbrella would be hypersexual arousal disorder. So you want to look for impulsive control disorders or something where it is impulsive, and we're finding that just in general is becoming a problem because of how readily available things are. Mm-hmm. Impulse control disorder, sexual disorder, NOS, not so much for women, the paraphilia disorders, that would be a little bit more for men, but delusional disorders because of the fantasy piece,
yes.
Nature of it, yeah, which is really interesting. ADD, ADHD, where we find that there's difficult time focusing, difficult time regulating that. Sex addiction can be a drug to calm the self to really help with that piece.
Mm-hmm.
What we find is certain medications could contribute to the symptoms of what we're finding is being presented in session. So we want to be able to make sure that we're looking at the prescriptions that clients are on and seeing if those have any sexual side effects that could increase the arousal, increase the compulsive behaviors, any kind of medical condition, like a big one is brain tumors. What we're finding is that because of the if there's a brain tumor in the prefrontal cortex, that could have a huge contribution to any kind of impulsive behavior. So looking at traumatic brain injury, any kind of injury for the prefrontal cortex is going to be important. But then also looking at co-occurring disorders that could be also contributing at the same time, or could be the main disorder, like depressive disorders, dissociative disorders is another big one, PTSD, disorders of extreme stress, substance abuse or dependence. Eating disorders, we're finding there's actually some good research that's happening that is finding that the number one co-occurring disorder for female sex and love addiction is eating disorder. And so that information should be coming out soon. But personality disorders, somatic symptoms, so just because hypersexual arousal disorder isn't in the DSM-5, we can still kind of filter through what else is going on here. How else can we understand this problem?
And how often do you see women with female sex and love addiction who also were survivors of child sexual abuse?
Yeah, so I thought that this would actually be more prevalent for female sex and love addiction, and so I had a bias almost going into this part of the field thinking, I'm assuming a lot of women are going to have some abuse, some sexual abuse in the past. And though there are some women who have this, it's not as large as I thought it would be. And so that was an interesting situation for me to find myself in. So that's why it's important to not just assume that just because someone's presenting with a sexual disorder, a sexual dysfunction, a sexual addiction, that that must mean that they have some kind of hidden sexual abuse or present sexual abuse going on in their life. So it's not as prevalent as I thought it would be, but it is definitely there.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Is there anything we should specifically look at to rule out? Is there something, when we're making this diagnosis, should we first be looking to rule anything out?
Yes, there is something, and I've gotten some referrals from some other physicians and therapists where the client seems to be presenting with female sex and love addiction, but it's actually a medical concern. And one of those concerns is called PGAD, also PSAS, which is persistent genital arousal disorder. And persistent genital arousal disorder is an intense genital feeling that can lead to hypersexual arousal response. So however the genital feelings can occur, the genital feelings, what happens is that there can be a tingling sensation or a sensation where it feels like I'm having an orgasm, I need to have an orgasm, otherwise this is going to be very painful. The orgasm is typically really painful, and it's usually very unwanted. No associated feelings that the woman can identify that triggers the response. And the feelings of needing to masturbate multiple times a day to get rid of the sensation is something that happens with persistent genital arousal disorder. And it can occur due to simply just exercising on a bike, being in a car, just walking with jeans on, and the experience a preoccupation about needing to masturbate and it being very frustrating and it not being something that they want is typically what these women go through. So that's persistent genital arousal disorder. And that's different than hypersexual arousal disorder because hypersexual arousal is an intense sexual desire with or without a genital sensation. So usually feeling satisfied after the orgasm, even though there is this feeling of guilt and shame afterwards, there's a desire or act. The desire or act is usually triggered by a certain stimuli, like the core messages or some kind of visual stimulation or the habit of going to a certain place or the internet. And the experience is more obsessive, has more obsessive thoughts about wanting sex and needing to have sex and that conquer and that power of having that. So it's important to rule out and make sure that it's not something medical like persistent genital arousal disorder or, you know, the medications that are occurring. So it's good to look at that first and make sure that that's not happening.
Yeah, and okay, so if someone has this arousal disorder, does the masturbation actually extinguish the impulse?
Are you saying, like, once the masturbation happens and the orgasm happens, does that feeling go away?
Yes.
It, for some it does. For others, it just comes back pretty quickly. So many of these women find that they're masturbating multiple times a day to get rid of this feeling. Yeah.
You mentioned some medications that we should be aware of. Can you name any of the medications that would make it difficult for you to diagnose?
Yes, I have them. I'm going to try and say them.
Okay.
Yeah. So carbidopa, have you heard of that?
No.
And then levodopa. Pramixipoxoli, and then ropinirola.
Okay, I don't know those. They might have another name too, but okay, that's interesting.
But they're all associated with increasing sexual and compulsive behaviors.
Okay, let's say a woman comes in to see you and she says, I feel like I have a female sex and love addiction. She might not say those words, but, you know, she basically is saying. What is your course of treatment? What does your course of treatment look like with this individual?
So typically what I would say with this individual is ask her to explain what is happening and why she feels like she fits into this category. So I would want to hear her story. I would want to hear what puts her in that, because sometimes there have been false information, and so they're actually functioning under a very normal sexual functioning, and sometimes it is, but they are correct, and they're it might be a little bit more obsessive or compulsive. So I get to understand what's been going on, what's been happening, but I also have in the back of my mind somewhat of an assessment of the questions that I'm asking to pull information out. And one of the assessments that is really great is called the Women's Sexual Addiction Screening Test. And just looking through that, you can pull out some questions that might be really beneficial in helping you understand if this person has an addiction, if this person might need help for female sex and love addiction. So have they tried to get help before and it hasn't worked? Do they spend hours, they lose track of time when they're engaged in this behavior? How do they feel after the situation? You know, asking some of the questions that could help you understand if this is truly an addiction, if it's just this problematic behavior, if, like, what's really going on with this person. And then typically what happens is, if there is something going on, we set up goals for what they're needing in terms of moving forward with the addiction. So say it's they have a problem with the internet. How can we get the internet out of their environment? How can we shut off the internet from their apartment or their house, or having them only use the internet when they're at, like, Starbucks or something like that, which is a little bit more tricky for women because if it's more fantasy-based, they can still get onto those websites and people wouldn't notice if they're watching porn or not necessarily. So really trying to figure out what behaviors do we need to reduce, and then also how can we start to do a really in-depth history about what was going on. So I do a pretty intense history with all of my clients because I want to try and figure out what where this was, where this started, where they think it started, and what all could have been contributing to how this became to be, and then we work on that. We work on attachment pieces because that plays a big piece in all of this. We work on core messages and where those came from, and so not only are we reducing the behavior and working on that, but we're also trying to figure out how can we heal some of those things that caused or contributed to the addiction itself.
Can you say a little bit about the attachment pieces? I know you've referred to it a couple of times. So will you explain to us what you mean by?
Yeah, so attachments that are formed whenever we're younger, like secure attachments, ambivalent attachments, avoidant, the disorganized attachment can play a big role in how we are engaging in our sexual addiction and engaging in the love and sex addiction, specifically for women because of the love piece, because it being more relational. Mm. So, for instance, if there's someone that has a disorganized attachment and they are doing this conquest piece and they're saying, so disorganized attachment would be like, I love you, get away from me. Mm. So this idea of, I love you, I want to power you, I want to, like, have all of this over you, I want to feel desired by that, and then, no, this is disgusting, like, back off, get away, I don't want any, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's really important to figure out what attachment styles is happening with these individuals, with people in their lives, what's been going on, how were they, one of the big questions I ask is, when you were younger, when you were sad, upset, happy, who would you go to? Mm-hmm. And if they said nobody, that gives me a big clue, a big red flag that that could be where it all started, that there might be an avoidant attachment there because of that, or, you know. So that question in itself helps me understand attachment and what relationships looks like, how they were able to get their needs met as a child.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then growing up, what did that look like? Because attachments can be fluid and change, and so what we want to help do is also, when doing the background history and working on the core messages, is creating a space where we can also help heal some of those attachment wounds to create more secure attachments for them moving forward.
Mm-hmm. What resources do you know about? So somebody's listening to this podcast and they want to do some further research. What kind of resources can you offer that person?
Yeah. So definitely, again, the assessment piece. You don't have to use it as your main thing, as we don't want to ever use one assessment for our main diagnostic piece, but it can at least give you an idea of what's been going on and how they've answered the question. So that's the Women's Sexual Addiction Screening Test.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, exactly. And then this one I think is huge. It just came out in 2013, and it's really the main book for female sex and love addiction. And so it's kind of like the pioneer for what I think is the pioneer book for female sex and love addiction. And it's called Making Advances.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a comprehensive guide for treating female sex and love addiction.
Hmm.
And there's tons of different authors in the field who have started studying this. Marnie Faree is really the pioneer, who I consider the pioneer in this field. So she has a main voice in this book. So if you really want to understand female sex and love addiction too, I would seek her out. I would look for her stuff because she's a big person in the field. Of course, there's Patrick Carnes who...
Yeah.
Coined sex addiction, and then there's Rob Weiss.
Mm-hmm.
So those are really the three people that I would suggest.
Mm-hmm.
There's without kind of overwhelming the audience, I would start out with those. There are books that are really, they're supposed to be for men and women, but they're really designed for men. But something that I led two female groups, and a book that they found really beneficial was called Facing the Shadows, Starting Sexual and Relationship Recovery. And it's a workbook that Patrick Carnes created, and it just helps you kind of, it goes along with some of his other books that he has, but it allows the person to read up on psycho-ed information, but it also allows them to go deeper and understand and get to know why this might be happening to them. So it is a little bit more geared toward men, but my women found it really beneficial.
Mm-hmm. Are there other kinds of therapies that you have found are helpful? I mean, art therapy, any other kind of therapy that you have found helpful when working with these women?
Yeah. So during my groups, we actually had an art therapist come in, and that was very healing for some of the women. A lot of recreational sports therapy can be really good in getting some of the deep anger out that could be just like sitting there, especially with trauma in the past as well. But a big one, of course, is, well, I mean, I say of course because I think it's beneficial in all ways, but mindfulness and meditative pieces. CBT has been the most effective with just sex therapy in general, but specifically sexual addiction. And so that is a great one to look at because of its effectiveness and research. So CBT, mindfulness. The big piece with any addiction is finding support and finding people to talk to so that you're not alone, so that you're not doing this by yourself, because that's the hardest piece, feeling like you're the only one.
Are there sexual addiction groups like Alcoholics Anonymous? And if so, how do you find them?
So there are, it's called Sexual Addiction Anonymous groups that you can go to. There's also Sex and Love Addiction Anonymous. What's difficult is that they're primarily men. And so what I was trying to create, I did my groups in the Cincinnati area, was getting so many women in the groups that there could be specific women's group. So there aren't a lot of them out there for women because there's still little information put out about what sex, female sex and love addiction looks like, and so women don't know where to go. So you can go to a SAA group or a SLAA group, and you can do that there. There's a movie that just came out called Thanks for Sharing, and I would encourage everyone to watch that movie because it talks about the recovery process. It talks about 12 steps and going through a recovery process for men and women. And the women, they kind of make the woman look more like a male sex addiction, but it's still a really great movie if you're struggling with this or you want to understand it a little bit more, the recovery process and how difficult it is. But it's surrounded by community and how support is so important for the process.
Well, this has certainly been a very interesting time. I want to ask you a final question, which is really a wrap-up question. ACA currently has 54,000-plus members, most of whom are clinicians. Is there anything I have not asked you that you want our members to know?
I would just say that the people who are studying this, the people who are in the field, we're still trying to understand it as well. And the unfortunate piece is that there's really not a lot of resources out there for women. And so whenever I started my groups, I didn't really know that much about female sex and love addiction, but I knew that I wanted to provide a safe place for support for women who were struggling with this. So even if you're not that familiar with it, just throw your feet in, research, read the books, and start to learn with your clients, because it's really important to have a safe place where there's support for other women out there.
Yes.
And so I think that is definitely something that I would suggest, even if you feel like you're not that competent, you know, get some supervision around it, but try and start some groups.
I get calls sometimes from clinicians who are living in very remote parts of the United States or in other countries, and they will, they feel like they really have to take every diagnosis that comes through the door because they're a rural counselor. And so with something like this, it seems like you and the client could learn together if that's what you needed to do and there weren't other groups or anything around.
Exactly, yeah. And then you start to become an expert in that field.
And they do too. Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us, Emma Schmidt. This was really interesting.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
All right. Thank you for joining us to discuss female sex and love addiction. To view links to this program, to write to the presenter or the host, please go to www.counseling.org and click on the podcast page. This is Dr. Rebecca Danielberg, your host for the ACA 2014 podcast series, signing off.